Summertime means popsicles, pies, and ice cream cones. But there's a sour side to all those sweet treats, including foods that aren't even dessert.
Of the 600,000 items in the American food supply, 80% are spiked with added sugar.
Warm weather also means vacations, and the man who changed Fantasyland forever. Now, 50 years after some of his greatest creations, we'll look at the lasting impact of Walt Disney.
He had created a new process that would make the combination of animation and live action much smoother.
Plus, why peer pressure may actually do your kids some good this summer.
If my kid gets into trouble, I'm going to chalk that up to peer pressure. If my kid is very well behaved, I wouldn't call that peer pressure. I would call it, she's a great kid. But in fact, it's also peer pressure.
I'm Kara Miller. That's all coming up next on Innovation Hub. From WGBH Radio and PRI, this is Innovation Hub.
Innovation Hub is sponsored by State Street, partnering with institutional investors worldwide to create the way ahead.
Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. As we launch into summer, a time of lemonade and soft serve ice cream, we're entering a season filled with food, picnics, barbecues, clam bakes. But a warning. You may want to put that slushy down. The latest science on sugar shows that it could be behind a lot of our medical problems in the West. We need to change our approach to the sweet stuff, at least according to Dr. Robert Lustig. He's a pediatric endocrinologist at the University of California, San Francisco, and his view of sugar has helped inspire a feature film, Fed Up.
There are 600,000 food items in America. 80% of them have added sugar.
Your brain lights up with sugar just like it does with cocaine or heroin. You're going to become an addict.
You end up with one of the great public health epidemics of our time.
So, Robert Lustig, when you first proposed the idea that sugar could be harming us and actually making us sick, what was the initial reaction to that?
Well, first of all, I want to make it very clear to the audience that sugar is not the only problem in our diet. By my count, there are 8 separate problems in the American diet. The two littles are too little fiber, too little omega-3 fatty acids, and too little micronutrients. The too much are too much trans fats, too much branched chain amino acids, that's leucine, isoleucine, and valine, which you get from corn-fed beef, chicken, and fish, too much omega-6 fatty acids, which are pro-inflammatory, too much alcohol, and finally, too much sugar. The reason to focus on sugar is because it's the single ingredient that the food industry specifically adds to get the American public to buy more. Of those other nutrients, there are reasons to include them, not to include them. Some of them actually have nutrient value. Dietary sugar has no nutrient value. It is only an energy source. And since it is there specifically because the food industry wants it to be there, it's the most actionable of the targets.
What made you think that sugar was what to concentrate on? Because, look, I mean, if you went back 30 years and you looked at how people thought about losing weight, it was reduce fat. I mean, even now, right, you go into the store and there's all sorts of low-fat things, from cottage cheese, right, to there's peanut butter with less fat. So what made you think about focusing on sugar in the first place?
First of all, you know Einstein's definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Well, you know what? We've been doing the same thing over and over again for the last 30 years, and things have only gotten worse, not better. We've gone low fat and things have actually gone out of control in the opposite way. In fact, the reason why we said dietary fat was the problem was based on a false premise. Over the last 7 to 9 years, it's become very apparent that fat is not the problem that we made it out to be. In addition, we also learned that there are 7 different kinds of fat. So when you get rid of fat, you get rid of all 7 kinds. Turns out some of those fats are actually good for you. The question is, why did we abdicate our diet, you know, for this low-fat alternative. There was a holy war that went on within nutrition back in the 60s and 70s. And there were two factions. There was the faction that said dietary fat caused heart disease, and there was the faction that said sugar caused heart disease. Now, the person who was in charge of, you know, the sugar being the cause of heart disease was a British physiologist, nutritionist, ended up becoming a physician by the name of Professor John Yudkin. Yudkin made the argument that sugar consumption correlated with the incidence of cardiovascular disease and actually other diseases as well. On the other side, we had Dr. Ansel Keys, who was convinced that saturated fat was the culprit instead. Three things happened during the 1970s which sealed Dr. Yudkin's fate. The first was the discovery of this protein, this molecule in our bloodstream called LDL, low-density lipoprotein. And today, it is still the thing that is measured as being the primary risk factor for coronary heart disease. LDL in large populations does correlate with coronary heart disease. The problem is, on an individual basis, LDL is almost useless, and that's a big problem. The second thing that happened was we learned that dietary fat raised your LDL. And then the third thing that happened was that these large population studies showed that LDL correlated with heart disease. So therefore, we said, well, if dietary fat raises your LDL and LDL correlates with heart disease, let's get rid of dietary fat, let's lower LDL, and heart disease will disappear. Yudkin was thrown under the bus as a zealot and a heretic and completely discredited, and we went low fat. This, of course, led to the Entenmann's low fat, you know, fat-free cakes and the Snackwells and virtually everything else that's come along, the low-fat yogurt, etc. The problem is, when you take the fat out of the food, it tastes like cardboard. The food industry knew that. So I said, well, what are we going to do to make the food palatable? Answer, add the sugar. And so the sugar content of individual foods started being ramped up and ramped up. And what the food industry saw was, hey, America's buying it. And they started experimenting and realized that the more sugar they added, the more we bought. They said, this is a gold mine. And so they started adding sugar to everything. And now, of the 600,000 items in the American food supply, 80% are spiked with added sugar, specifically for the food industry's purposes, because they know when they add it, you buy more. The problem is, which was worse, the fat or the sugar? The sugar 1,000 times over.
It's interesting. I mean, it sounds from what you're saying like there is a real gap between what the doctor on the ground dealing with patients knows and what the newest, most sort of cutting edge nutrition science really is.
Absolutely. It's enormous. It's a very big gap. It's a huge chasm. And the problem is that people are getting information from so many different sources. It's hard to break through the cacophony of gobbledygook that's out there. I liken nutrition to Harry Potter's Defense Against the Dark Arts class. You know, teachers come and teachers go. The rules change from episode to episode. Nobody ever knows what's going on. They kind of make it up as they go along. You know, there are a lot of snake oil salesmen in nutrition. I'm telling you, I am not here to sell you anything. I am here to tell you that the food we used to eat worked, and the food we eat today doesn't. It's called processed food. When you process it, you do two things. You add the sugar and you remove the fiber. If we returned ourselves to a real food diet, these problems would disappear.
Let me just take the skeptic's point of view here, which is I look around. And I know a lot of thin people who eat a lot of dessert. If you go to France, for example, walk around Paris, you see patisseries on every corner, and a lot of thin people are buying things in those patisseries and eating them. Yeah. How do you reconcile, you know, the notion that sugar makes you fat with the fact that there are a lot of people all over the world that eat a lot of desserts and are not fat?
Well, they don't eat a lot of desserts. Let's be very honest. They do eat some. I mean, you know, if you go to Italy, there are gelato places. But, you know, mostly for the Americans. You know, the Italians don't eat a whole lot of gelato. Yes, there are patisseries all over France. But, you know, they don't eat more than, you know, like one a day, even if that. You know, I've been to France many times. I've been to Italy many times. And, you know, I would argue the point that they spend a lot of time in their patisseries doing that. A little dessert is okay. It's a lot that's not.
I'm Kara Miller. This is Innovation Hub, and I'm speaking with Robert Lustig. He is the author of Fat Chance. And you've said that sugar actually affects thinking, our ability to concentrate on what we're doing. How does sugar affect us in ways other than maybe just putting on weight?
So sugar causes liver fat accumulation. And when you're overweight, insulin resistant, fed, and you consume fructose, sugar, you're going to make liver fat out of it. That liver fat causes a phenomenon which we call insulin resistance. It raises insulin levels all over the body. Well, insulin resistance is associated with changes in cognitive function and dementia. In animal models, Fernando Gomez Pena at UCLA has shown that fructose is a specific neurotoxin which can be altered in terms of its toxicity by the administration of omega-3 fatty acids. Well, we get those from wild fish and flax, an item that's particularly notoriously deficient in the American diet.
And you've asked the real hot-button question here, could sugar be addictive?
This is a question that we do not have the final answer to. In animals, I can tell you, slam dunk, yes. The answer is yes. And the human data shows without question that sugar causes the phenomenon of tolerance, that is, the downregulation of dopamine receptors within the reward center. What that means is that a little sugar won't give you the same benefit of reward when the receptors that transduce the information are downregulated. That means you need more to accomplish the same effect. That's called tolerance. It's the same as tolerance to any drug of abuse.
I was going to say, it sounds like drugs were a little bit works at the beginning, but once you acclimate to that, it's not enough anymore.
That's right. And you have to raise the dose in order to get the same effect. Ultimately, you're consuming a lot for very little. And that's the phenomenon of tolerance. Does sugar cause tolerance in humans? Absolutely, 100% data in the bank, no ifs, ands, or buts. The question is the other side, withdrawal. Withdrawal is actually kind of a hard thing to come by. One of the biggest problems in trying to figure this out is that most people who are ostensibly sugar addicted are mainlining it, that is, drinking a soda. That's the sugar of choice because it gets absorbed so rapidly. Well, guess what else is in soda? Caffeine. So the question is, when people go off soda, they definitely get withdrawal. They get the headaches. They get the jitteriness. They will tell you about all those things. But is it the caffeine withdrawal or is it sugar withdrawal or is it both? We don't know the answer to that yet.
So if this is something that is obviously so important, or in your view, so important to the population of the U.S., so important to the population of the world, we see the percentage of obese people has doubled in the last 30 years. Where do you see it going? I mean, not where do you see it going, where you wish it would go. Where is it actually going?
Look, I'm going to tell you right now. Obesity is a red herring. Obesity is not the issue. It's about chronic metabolic disease. Obesity doesn't cause death. The diseases that go with obesity cause death. Obesity does not break the medical bank. The diseases that go with obesity break the medical bank. $245 billion for diabetes, $200 billion for dementia. That's $500 billion for two chronic metabolic diseases, both of which are preventable. Now, that's kind of sick. Here's how to think about it. Obesity is going up at the rate of 1% per year worldwide, but diabetes is going up at the rate of 4% per year worldwide. So, if obesity is the cause of diabetes, how can diabetes be going up faster? Not possible. Second, let's look at the American adult population, 240 million people, 30% of which are obese. That's 72 million. 80% of those obese people are metabolically ill. They have diabetes, they have hypertension, they have dyslipidemia, they have cardiovascular disease, they have cancer, they have dementia. That's 57 million. And the population, the Americans, say they're the problem. If they could only just eat less and exercise more, we could solve this problem. It's their fault. But if 80% are metabolically ill, that means 20% are metabolically healthy. They will not cost the taxpayer a dime. They will live a completely normal life. They're just fat. Conversely, it turns out that 40% of the normal weight population have the exact same metabolic dysfunctions as do the obese. They get type 2 diabetes. They get dyslipidemia. They get hypertension. They get cardiovascular disease. They get cancer. They get dementia at a slightly lower rate, true, but they get it too. And when you do the math, that's 67 million people. There are more of them than there are obese metabolically ill people. And the reason is because it's not about obesity. It's about the inflammation that comes with what we eat that leads to the metabolic dysfunction, and even normal weight people can get it. This is a public health crisis.
Dr. Robert Lustig is the author of Fat Chance. He's the director of the University of California, San Francisco Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program, and he is also the author of the recently released Fat Chance Cookbook. Robert Lustig, thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Kara.
Coming up, why peer pressure could help kids do better at math. You can find out more about our guests and their work at innovationhub.org and follow us on Twitter to find out more about upcoming shows and the news that is catching our eye each week. We're at iHub Radio. From PRI and WGBH Radio, I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub. Don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer, in the city. Cool town, meeting in the city, dressed so fine and looking so pretty. Cool. Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Right now, lots of kids are looking forward to trading in school for camp and homework for beachy days filled with friends. For parents, though, the power of peer pressure is always something to grapple with, a potential gateway to drinking or drugs. But it turns out that a lot of peer pressure can steer kids and adults towards better behavior. Tina Rosenberg is a winner of the Pulitzer Prize and a MacArthur Genius Grant, and she's the author of Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. And Tina Rosenberg, I'm wondering how you got thinking that peer pressure is a good thing, because I've always thought of it as a force that, let's say, encouraged kids to skip class or to bully other kids.
Well, of course, that is peer pressure. But peer pressure is just as powerful in the other direction. We don't tend to think of it as powerful because it's invisible. You know, if my kid gets into trouble, I'm going to chalk that up to peer pressure. If my kid is very well behaved and respectful and does everything she should do, I wouldn't call that peer pressure. I would call it, she's a great kid, or, you know, I've given her excellence in parenting. But in fact, it's also peer pressure. It's partly due to the fact that she's chosen a group of kids to hang out with who reward and support that kind of behavior. And peer pressure is a very powerful force. It's almost all-powerful for teenagers, but it's just as powerful in the other direction.
Okay, so give me a sense of how you change the dynamic and use peer pressure in a positive way.
People don't change their behavior because they have information, and they don't change their behavior because they're afraid. But they do change through identification. They change their behavior because they say, I can be like my friend whose life has changed. Information doesn't work. We all know what we should and shouldn't eat. We all know that we shouldn't smoke, and yet we still do. And I think a lot of people in the public health field have long relied on the idea that, oh, we'll just tell people what's good for them and they'll do it. Commercial advertisers don't rely on that. They know that that's not true.
Let's dive into education there for a second. You talk about a really interesting sort of experiment, essentially, that went on at UC Berkeley to try to help to get underperforming minorities to do better in, of all things, calculus. How did they come upon this experiment and how did it work?
Well, you wouldn't think that calculus would be something that would be susceptible to positive peer pressure, but it turned out to be hugely important. This came about in the 1970s, and there was a grad student at Berkeley named Yuri Treisman who was very interested in the question of why it was that Latino and Black students did so badly in calculus. Calculus is the gateway to any career in the math or science world. But very, very few kids did well in calculus at Berkeley, even if they had already taken it in high school and already done well in it in high school. They would come to Berkeley and they would get an F or a D. So Treisman took a movie camera and he asked math grad assistants to point out 20 kids who were doing very badly in calculus and 20 kids who were doing very well. And he essentially moved into their dorms with them over the next year and a half and filmed them. The 20 kids were Black who were doing badly, and the 20 kids who were doing well were all Asian. And what he found at the end of this year and a half of filming is that the Black kids studied alone and the Asian kids studied in groups. And that was responsible for a large part of the difference. So he set up these math discussion sections for calculus. You went to the same lecture as everyone else, but you had these discussion sections three times a week that were taught in a completely different way by your teaching assistant, where kids met in groups of three or four and they worked on extra challenging problems. These were problems that were harder than the homework. And the teacher was not allowed to tell you anything about how to solve them. The kids had to help each other. And this was very, very successful. The number of Black and Latino students who were getting B's and A's in calculus soared. Black and Latino students to this day at Berkeley in these classes do at least a half a grade point better than whites and Asians who are not in these classes. And this has now spread to dozens, if not hundreds, of universities all around the United States.
Okay, so one question is it important to be in study sections with people like you? So, I mean, the example you gave with Asians initially is they were in study sessions with people who are also Asian. So if you're Hispanic, is it important to be in a study group with people who are also Hispanic?
Sometimes it is important to have peers who are like you. That's the most credible person to deliver a message. In this case, I don't think it was that important. I think what was important was, first of all, working as a group is a very effective way to study something. You are able to ask questions of your fellow student that you would not raise your hand to ask in a class because you're afraid of looking stupid. And also, you get a better sense of where you are. Treisman found that the Black kids who were doing poorly had no idea they were doing poorly until they got their grade back from the test because they had nothing to measure themselves against. But most important, they developed math friends. And this was key. And it did not have to be same race friends, but it had to be friends who you did academic things with. The Black kids, before these classes, they had friends and they had their academic colleagues, but those groups didn't overlap. Once they had these special calculus sections, which are called emerging scholars programs, that group started to overlap. And that's what made the difference.
So if this is so effective in the sort of positive peer pressure of do well in this class and we're all asking questions, so it's okay to ask questions, why hasn't it spread beyond dozens or hundreds of universities? Why isn't it everywhere? Why isn't it in high schools? It seems like the idea of peer pressure is not used extensively in education, at least as far as I've seen.
No, you're right. Although I think there is a lot more group work in education at all levels than there used to be. You know, my kids go to public elementary schools in New York City, and they do a lot of their studying in groups. And I don't think that was true even probably 10 years ago or so. But I found when I was researching the book that a lot of programs that were extremely successful struggled to stay alive for reasons that you would think would be almost trivial. For example, a lot of math departments would have a grad student who came out of an emerging scholars program somewhere and wanted to set up the program in their own math department, but they couldn't get the few hundred dollars they needed to set up the section and, you know, maybe have some petty cash for pizza. Or grad students are expected to work extra hard on getting tenure by writing publishable papers, and so they didn't have time to do something like this. And so the whole thing just fell by the wayside. I mean, over and over again, organizations fail to do what is in their interest because of really stupid reasons. And a lot of times, programs like this get affected.
I wonder if you ever worry about the downsides of peer pressure. I mean, we've been talking about the positive effects that it can have, especially when it comes to education. But do you ever worry about the really dark sides of peer pressure?
I do worry about it, but that's the part of peer pressure that everyone worries about. For example, there's a lot of evidence that young men who become terrorists, Muslim violent extremists, get radicalized through negative peer pressure. They're far from home. They're far from their own towns and their way of living. And they meet a group of people, for example, at a university they're studying at in Europe for the 9/11 terrorists that was in Hamburg. And the group gradually radicalizes itself. And people egg each other on to more and more radical statements. And then they make contact with Al-Qaeda or another terrorist organization, and off you go. And peer pressure has a lot to do with this. But there's also programs. There was one program that I wrote about in London that uses peer pressure to de-radicalize people. And it's run by a group of Salafi Muslims, people who share pretty extreme views on religion. For example, the women are completely covered, just their eyes showing. It's a very, very fundamentalist conservative version of Islam. But these are exactly the people who have the credibility to talk to a young man and say, I know what you're thinking. I share your grievances. But let me tell you what the Quran really says. And let me tell you that violence is not the way. And we're loath to support those people because a lot of what they believe is really offensive to us. But these are the groups that are the most effective at turning young men away from terrorism.
How do you see technology? I mean, when you think about terrorism, certainly the ability that technology provides to radicalize people, to create online communities has been really powerful. And I wonder how you see technology playing out there or just more generally in creating these peer pressure communities, in a sense.
I think that technology like Facebook and Twitter can play an important role in using positive peer pressure. It allows you to communicate with members pretty easily, and it allows you to communicate that you're a big group. One of the reasons that the April 6th movement in Egypt was able to grow was that they had 70,000 Facebook friends. Now, this didn't help them to organize particularly, but it attracted members because you could look on Facebook and you can see, oh, yeah, I'm part of something really big. And I think that is the most important use of technology. I don't believe technology so far has proven to be a substitute for face-to-face contact in being able to change people's behavior through positive peer pressure. I mean, the classic example of positive peer pressure is Alcoholics Anonymous. You want to change your behavior, so you form a group with other people who will support you in that change and hold you accountable. And that's very effective. But it's very difficult to imagine that successfully happening online. I really believe that positive peer pressure to work must be face-to-face.
Finally, what is one place where you wish that peer pressure was being used, but it's not? Like, you would love to see it deployed.
There's so many possible ways to answer that. I think that I would like to see more of programs like the one in London I described that fight terrorism. I would love to see more programs in schools that use positive peer pressure to fight bullying because it's very effective. Just about any kind of human behavior can be changed more effectively through identification than through the methods that we're really accustomed to using.
Tina Rosenberg is the author of Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. She's a winner of the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, and a MacArthur Genius Grant. She also writes for the New York Times column Fixes. Tina Rosenberg, thanks so much for coming in.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Summertime, and the living is easy.
So, as you're snacking on that hot dog this summer, think for a minute about the ketchup it's smothered in and the guy who made ketchup a sensation in the U.S. His name was H.J. Heinz. And if you're wondering why Heinz talks about having 57 varieties, it's because he was pretty obsessed with numbers. we talked to author Joshua Kendall about how that kind of obsession made Henry Heinz a household name.
He loved odd numbers when he was traveling to Europe. He loved factoids. He would count. He would make sure that he knew exactly how many passengers were in steerage class. But if you think about it, his legacy is also associated with a factoid. Every time we have a burger, we see Heinz 57. And that's one of the most successful advertising slogans in history. And it starts with him in the 1890s seeing a sign in New York, 21 styles of shoes. At the time, he was really a pickle king. Ketchup wasn't a big deal, but he had about 65 products. And he says to himself, 57, 57. It didn't really mean anything. But as part of his eccentricity, when he has his first grandchild, he writes to his son and say, congratulations on the birth of the 58th variety.
So now if you are thinking about in what way this obsession made H.J. Heinz a great innovator, he didn't create pickles. And he didn't really create ketchup either.
No.
So what about him was so innovative?
Well, I think he creates a whole new industry. He grew up near Pittsburgh in a German family. His parents were German immigrants. Things were a little bit hard, and his mother had 8 children, so she has a lot of mouths to feed. And at age 5, he's helping her grading and bottling the family's horseradish. And that becomes the lifelong obsession. And he creates a whole new industry, which is mass-produced processed food. In the 19th century, women in the kitchen, men didn't cook much, had few things they could turn to, and they couldn't trust them. So he puts his pickles in clear glass bottles so people can see exactly what they're getting. And again, mass-produced processed food is a whole new thing.
He, as you say, he has this pioneer in branding. And one of the things he figured out is that it's not just about the food that you're making. It's about all the stuff that goes around it. He made pickle cards. I don't even know what that is.
Yeah.
Pickle spoons, calendars, souvenir books, pickle charms. Pickle charms?
Yeah. Well, he was a master at advertising. And one of his innovations was to plow, you know, a third of his profits back into advertising, unheard of sums. He would go to these world's fairs, and I think it's 1893 in Chicago, when no one is going to his booth, and he gives people a little ticket and says, if you march to my booth, we'll give you a little pickle pin. And the pickle pin was an ingenious idea because then customers become walking advertisements. He really figured out advertising. He had signs all over Pittsburgh, and again, he loved to measure things, so he loved that was another one of his quirks that he used to carry a steel tape measure around with him at all times, and whenever he saw an unsuspecting doorway, sometimes he'd be in the middle of a meeting, he would just take a measurement. But he loved to measure his signs and put them up all over Pittsburgh and around the world, actually.
And this is, you know, the late 1800s is not a time of sort of global brands the way we think of now, but he is like at the forefront of thinking, we can put Heinz products here.
Exactly. He goes to England and everyone says, don't go. It's a waste of time. And he has a very clever advertising. And to this day, the Brits, more Brits eat baked beans for breakfast. A greater percentage of Brits eat that than any other place. And the Brits long thought that the baked bean company was a British company. It's really the Heinz Corporation. So Starbucks and all these international brands really have to tip their hat to Heinz.
So does that mean that baked beans was not part of an English breakfast before
he
convinced them
to make? More so than America.
And how do you explain that he was so smart about all this marketing when this is a guy who could barely write well? I mean, he couldn't write a business letter, barely had an education. What made him so good at figuring this stuff out?
Yeah, well, I mean, innovators, it doesn't necessarily require, you know, book learning. And if you think about, you know, the people in Silicon Valley today, it's this kind of conceptual intelligence. Heinz just had a razor-sharp mind. He could just attack problems in very creative ways, but it's a very kind of quick thinking. And he couldn't spell, and he would kind of calm himself down and say, well, Napoleon couldn't spell either. I mean, he's very cute when he goes to Corsica. But this is a man who was always on the go. He liked to – he couldn't play 18 holes of golf. He played like 6 holes of golf. He was constantly in a rush. But that's the kind of intelligence you need to solve business problems.
That's Joshua Kendall, author of America's Obsessives, The Compulsive Energy That Built a Nation. And up next, 50 years ago, Walt Disney changed movie making and technology. We'll tell you how. From PRI and WGBH Radio, I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub, online at innovationhub.org. And we're always available on iTunes and SoundCloud. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. When you think about Walt Disney the man, you probably imagine someone who loved nostalgia, carriages and cottages and cobblestone paths. And even at Disneyland, one of his most lasting legacies, Cinderella's castle is what is front and center. But Walt Disney was also a futurist, a guy who loved technology. And he got an amazing opportunity to indulge his techie side exactly 50 years ago at the 1964 World's Fair. At the fair, Disney debuted both an animatronic Abraham Lincoln and It's a Small World. And that same year marked another marriage of art and tech in the form of Mary Poppins, which was richly rewarded at the Oscars. Neil Gabler is the author of Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. And Neil Gabler, I want to talk about that crucial year, 1964. If Disney were to list his favorite films, do you think that Mary Poppins would be among them?
Absolutely, Mary Poppins would be among the films that that he thought most highly of and that he was proudest of. And he said that after the film. In fact, he wrote his sister when the film was being produced that he knew that they were doing something special. Everybody on that film knew they were doing something special. It was different than the kinds of films that the studio had been making, you know, from the late 1950s on. I mean, films like, you know, The Absent-Minded Professor and Son of Flubber and Shaggy D.A. I mean, those are the kinds of films in that era, late 50s, early 60s, that one associated with Walt Disney. Family movies, comedies. But Mary Poppins was different in all ways. For one thing, it was a giant movie. It was an expensive film. It was based on an important literary source, I mean, the Mary Poppins books. So that alone separated it from the kind of, I hate to call them negligible, but, you know, in the long eye of history, they're negligible movies. And he was thoroughly invested in that film, financially, but also emotionally.
So let's listen to a little clip of Mary Poppins. This is a piece from Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. And you'll hear here Mary Poppins and Bert the Chimney Sweep, and they're interacting with a cartoon character.
So when the cat has got your tongue, there's no need for dismay. Just summon up this word, and then you've got a lot to say. But better use it carefully, or it could change your life.
For example?
Yes?
One night I said it to me girl, and now me girl's me wife. Wow. And a lovely thing she is, too.
So, Neil Gabler, what, in your view, was so innovative about Mary Poppins? I mean, after all, Walt Disney had been combining live action and animation since the 1940s. This was not the first movie that did that. But what about this was new and different and interesting?
Well, in terms of the combination of animation and live action, he had created a new process with his longtime collaborator, Ub Iwerks. Ub Iwerks had drawn the original Mickey Mouse. And he had Iwerks work on a process that would make the combination of animation and live action much smoother and much more fully integrated than, say, it was in Song of the South. So that is an innovation. It's a technological innovation, not an aesthetic one necessarily, but it is an innovation. You know, many of the qualities of Mary Poppins are not so much, you know, a function of technological innovation as they are just the fact that, I mean, the movie is extremely well made, well written, well acted, with a wonderful musical score.
And they really reimagined the book Mary Poppins. I mean, we've seen the,
yes,
in the recent movie Saving Mr. Banks that P.L. Travers, who wrote Mary Poppins, was not that happy with the way that Walt Disney wanted to adapt her movie. And we actually have a little bit of that of the movie Saving Mr. Banks. And you'll hear here Walt Disney sort of warned by his secretary that P.L. Travers has a lot of ideas that are different from his.
Now, let us begin.
From here.
She has a lot of ideas.
What kind of ideas?
Constables responsible.
Now, how does that sound?
No. Responsible is not a word.
We made it up.
Well, unmake it up.
Neil Gabler, is there truth to this contentious relationship that Disney and Travers had?
Absolute truth. The genesis of this film was extremely long. God created the world in a much shorter amount of time than it took Walt Disney to make this movie and to get Travers to agree. It was a matter of decades. And a large part of the delay in that process was that Travers just didn't want to cooperate. She didn't like Walt Disney particularly. At least she, I'm not talking personally, but I'm talking in terms of the kinds of films he made. And interestingly, she didn't like the approach that Disney had taken to the material, both narratively and in terms of the values. At one point, she said to Walt Disney, she didn't want the children sliding up the banister because that violated the discipline that the parents had imposed. She didn't want the little boy jumping in puddles. So what kind of person was this Mary Poppins who was constantly contravening the rules that the parents had laid down? I mean, I think there's one interesting story about the film and Travers' participation in that when she saw the parts of the book they had chosen for the screenplay, her idea, and she'd actually written a treatment of her own, was to take almost exactly the opposite scenes of the book and put it in her screenplay. So they were very much loggerheads about the film. And they were also at loggerheads about the innovative element that we discussed, which was the animation, combination of animation and live action. She just could not countenance, even though Walt Disney had raised this issue early on in the process, she could not countenance the idea of there being cartoons in her movie. Of course, that's one of the things now, as we look at Mary Poppins, that we think most fondly on.
I'm Kara Miller. This is Innovation Hub from PRI and WGBH Radio, and we're speaking with Neil Gabler, the author of Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. So what gave Disney the sort of stick-to-itiveness through all this adversity to say, no, I really, really want to do Mary Poppins. It's worth whatever heartache it takes to get to that final product, which eventually was really well-reviewed by critics and won the Best Actress Oscar for Julie Andrews?
Walt Disney was someone who stayed the limit. He would constantly work on something until it was right. There were many projects in the studio that he had generated early on and then weren't realized until much later on. Mary Poppins was only one of many of those. When he believed in something, he was fully committed to it. And we see this in not only the films, but also in a project like Disneyland, which, you know, he had first gotten the idea for. We don't know exactly when, but he started thinking seriously about it sometime in the 1940s. It wasn't built until and opened until, you know, 1955. But that's the way Walt Disney's mind worked. You don't give up on something. What you do instead is you find out how to make it happen. You find out ways to surmount the obstacles. And that's one of the things that made him so successful.
Well, and also you see in 1964, the same year that Mary Poppins came out, another technology that he was also working on that would end up in Disneyland was animatronics. And he debuted this animatronic technology at the 1964 World's Fair in New York. What made him so interested in this robotic technology, which is so, in some ways, for 1964, so forward-looking?
It certainly was. And now, to answer the question of Walt's, you know, fascination with audio animatronics, I mean, the simple answer is, you know, he loved technology. He had always loved technology. One of the things that had gotten him into animation was that technological component. It wasn't just art, but it also combined, you know, art with camera technology. But you got to go beyond that. Why was he so fascinated by technology? And I think, you know, the psychological answer, speculatively, of course, you know, is that Walt Disney was the master of control. And so much of the innovation that he brought to all the various things he did, whether it was animation or the theme park or ultimately the World's Fair, was in the service of control. Life itself was pretty messy. People are very messy. But machines are not. Machines, at least theoretically, function in exactly the way you program them to function if you program them properly and if you've understood the technology sufficiently. So I think a lot of the fascination with this was another way of mastering the world. It began with animation, which is a form of control and mastery. It moved on to Disneyland, which is another form of control and mastery. And it moved from there to the audio animatronics, which is an almost godlike form of control and mastery. Because what you're doing here is you're creating real, live creatures. And in the final analysis, in the case of the Abraham Lincoln robot that he created for the World's Fair, the Illinois Pavilion there, you're actually creating a real human being.
Well, it's interesting because there were people who were horrified by what he had done to Lincoln. Now, he really loved Lincoln, but he argued, look, I mean, robots, like you said, they're better workers. They look more like Lincoln than real people. And in a way, there was that kind of, well, you know, they will work all night and you can't find a person to do that.
That's exactly right. You know, and that's the argument, as you said, that he had given, is that, you know, you can do this Lincoln show again and again and again and again. I mean, ultimately, you have to change the clothing because it wears out, and you have to change some of the gears and the hydraulics and everything else that controlled this figure. But this figure could go on from here to eternity. And in fact, it has. You know, if you go to Disneyland, you can see Abraham Lincoln deliver the Gettysburg Address, the robotic Abraham Lincoln. So that was the excuse he used. But again, I think there was something deeper, which was I think Walt Disney always loved the idea that he could create life. And it's been said of Walt Disney, there were only two, you know, entities that could make the animate out of the inanimate. One was God and the other was Walt Disney. And I think that the World's Fair, and certainly the Abraham Lincoln robot, is a demonstration of Walt Disney playing God and doing so rather successfully.
I'm Kara Miller. This is Innovation Hub. We're speaking with Neil Gabler about Walt Disney on this 50th anniversary of both Mary Poppins and the 1964 World's Fair. One of the interesting things to me is that people associate Walt Disney so much with nostalgia, with looking back to old Europe, to these old fairy tales and reviving them. And yet, as you say, he was always so interested in the future. So at the 1964 World's Fair, he's trying to sell Robert Moses, the great planner of New York, on you should have a monorail in New York.
Absolutely. You know, Walt Disney was a nostalgist, and I don't want to discount that. When you enter Disneyland or you enter Disney World, you walk down Main Street, which was a replica of the Main Street of one of his boyhood towns, Marceline, Missouri. So there was a nostalgic component. He understood that, and he knew how to play on it. But he was always forward-looking as well. One of the things that we don't really think about in terms of Walt Disney, unless you watched his show religiously, was just how much Walt Disney served to inspire the space program. He did a number of shows on the exploration of space and worked closely with NASA to further their goals. He was always interested in science. You know, those were things that were deeply embedded in him, as deeply embedded as nostalgia. And when you think of the World's Fair, you know, he creates an exhibit for General Electric, which he then transplanted to Disneyland, and it was called the Carousel of Progress. And what was it? Well, it was a number of scenes, audio animatronic, that would rotate, and it would tell you kind of the history of technological America working toward the future. So Walt Disney was a visionary. He was a very forward-looking fellow, and that is every bit as much a part of his character as the nostalgia component.
Finally, I wonder if Walt Disney was ever able to sit back enough to enjoy the things that he had created. You quote Blaine Gibson, who worked on these animatronic figures, and he says, I'd be working late at night at the studio on something for the World's Fair, and I would leave around 2 a.m., and there Walt Disney would be in his pajamas and bathrobe. He was there reviewing our work and working on something. Now, for somebody who had achieved success, had a ton of money by this time, that is extraordinary.
Walt Disney never rested. He was always looking to the horizon. What's next? And even on his deathbed, he was looking at the ceiling tiles in the hospital, and he was planning out the grid for Epcot, which he hoped would be a fully operational city with all sorts of technological innovations, in which people would work and live and play. It never was realized. The Epcot at Disney World is not, it's a kind of glorified World's Fair. It's not the idea that Walt Disney had had. But I think it's interesting that Walt Disney was always thinking about the future. And in the last phase of his life, he was becoming a kind of gigantic urban planner with the idea that this is going to be the future of the world. This prototype will be transplanted all over the world. That's how Walt Disney thought.
Neil Gabler is a professor at Stony Brook Southampton and the author of Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. Neil Gabler, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
And head to iTunes or SoundCloud to grab today's conversations about how sugar really impacts us and how Walt Disney changed storytelling. Thanks to the people who helped put this show together. Producer Mary Dew, production assistant Genevieve Gilson, and engineer Alan Mattis. We also had contributions this week from senior producer Michelle Sweet. From PRI and WGBH Radio, I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.
Innovation Hub is sponsored by State Street, partnering with institutional investors worldwide to create the way ahead.
PRI, Public Radio International.